Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. This is Banal of America Audio, Season 8, live. Coming at you about 5 minutes late, so we got no proper start time either. I've always wondered what happens when you go past the start time of the live show. Apparently it just waits for you, which is a good thing to know. But anyway, we've got a really awesome program lined up for you folks. Our guest on this edition of the show appeared way back on BOA Audio Season 1, which is a stunning 8 years ago. I actually looked it up today. We posted her program. I couldn't figure out the exact date we taped the show, but we posted it on January 21st, 2006, which is absolutely insane. That's almost 8.5 years ago. Just way, 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 way too long. She's a pioneering researcher of the MyLab phenomenon, the military abduction phenomenon. That's what we talked about, 8 years ago. I can't believe it's been so long. And she's done some amazing stuff since. She's had a tremendous career as a researcher and investigator in the field of ufology for over 25 years. What I found out recently is that she has over 33 years of experience as a professional psychic as well and a teacher of psychic development. So we're going to get into that as well because I'm really very fascinated by that. And as I said, I didn't even know that originally when we first met. And before I bring her on the program, well, let me say hello first, then I'll keep rambling. Welcome back to the show, Melinda. It has been far, far too long, folks, talking about Melinda Leslie, as I said, pioneering researcher of the MyLab phenomenon. Welcome back, my friend.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I was going to say, what's up with that?
You moved.
Oh, yeah. Good excuse. Okay. No, I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
Believe me. I did reach out a few times, and I think I had your old phone number because I could never get a hold of you, but it all worked out again recently, so it's all good.
Now, you found me because I was on this, radio program you're also associated with, and I think that's how you found me.
No. To my credit, check your Facebook messages. I actually I messaged you back in September. I never heard back, though, Melinda, so.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
It's all good, though. A little in-house baseball on the show here at the beginning. But what I wanted to say is, I first met you in 2004, I think, at the X Conference in D.C., and I was really a newcomer to all this and didn't know anybody or anything really. And there was a lot of, let's call them celebrities with scare quotes around it, from the world of the paranormal there. And, you know, they had their entourages and stuff like that. And to a newbie like me, it was pretty intimidating, but there were folks, and I've put him over a million times for it, but since we haven't had you on so long, I haven't had the opportunity to keep putting you over for it as well. Peter Robbins was just the nicest guy that weekend, really made me feel welcome and at home in the world of ufology, and you did as well. And, if it wasn't for you, I really wouldn't have the, I never would have got the drive to really do this and get mixed up in all this. So I really thank you for that, and I'm looking forward to reconnecting.
I didn't know I had that effect on people, but no, very good. I think at the time you introduced yourself, maybe even then you said, I'm starting a radio program or something, or, and I meet so many people at conferences, but you try to I try to be gracious to everybody. You know, sometimes people are really annoying, but, you know,
oh, I know
90%
yeah.
of the people you try to be really, really gracious with. But thank you. Thanks. I'm glad I have that influence.
Yeah.
Because look what you've done.
I haven't forgotten it. I have not forgotten it.
Oh, thank you.
So I guess let's catch people up to speed on what you've been up to. Well, I'll start with the bio, the background, because it's been so long and some folks haven't dipped that far back in the archive yet. So tell people, you know, who is Melinda Leslie? As we said here, 25 years researching, investigating the ufological phenomenon, as one would have it, and 33 years as a psychic, which is tremendous. So tell me a little bit, you know, who is Melinda Leslie? How did this all sort of come together for you to develop in such an amazing career?
Oh, gosh. I'm like, seriously?
yeah,
okay.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Give us the elevator version.
I've been in ufology for 25 years. And as you read my bio, I also do readings. I've been involved in metaphysics pretty much my whole life, but really... really hardcore for 33 to 35 years, starting at some point when I was in high school, you know, just a child, but just kidding. And anyways, and then 25 years ago got involved in ufology. And I've had, you know, throughout this, I've had regular jobs too. I had regular bread and butter jobs and kind of always, as many people in the field do, you do these things on the side.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
It's very much a life path, and it may be separate from how you earn the living kind of thing. But
exactly.
Now, a little over 3 years ago, I moved to Sedona, and I'm in Sedona, Arizona, which is, if you've ever been here, it's stunningly gorgeous. And now I'm here, and I had always done readings on the side, and so I jumped into doing that full time. But I really moved here to start up these UFO tours that I do,
mm-hmm.
where I take people out with military night vision goggles to have UFO sightings. Last night, and I told this guy, I almost didn't do the tour last night. It was kind of a funny thing. I don't need to tell you a story. But I ended up just taking out one gentleman, and it ended up being at the last minute, and we had a great time. We had great sightings, but on the way driving there, it dawned on me, oh my God, this was my 300th tour.
Oh, wow.
And I'd already planned like a week before, saying, Kate, you know, at like tour 297, 298, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, 296. I was planning that when I had my 300th, I was going to contact the people ahead of time, say, let's meet for dinner and make it, you know, a special event being my 300th. And it ended up being a last-minute thing where the people were supposed to go. They pulled out. Anyway, long story short, boom, it was just me and him, and I'd forgotten about it being the 300th. So we're driving out in the car, and I'm like, oh, no. He's like, what? I just remember. And I told him, I said, you're my 300th tour. And it had, like, no fanfare or nothing. Very impromptu last-minute thing. And I thought, wouldn't you know, in its own way, there was something perfect about that.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
So anyhow, so but it was great. And so, long story short, there I've done 300 tours now.
Okay.
In 300 tours, where I'm taking people out with military night vision goggles, I use just so these people are wondering PVS 7A Generation 3 military night vision goggles, which allow for over 20,000 times more light than you see with your naked eye.
Wow.
And we've had so many signs. I actually guarantee people will have sightings or they get their money back. And I know a lot of people in ufology would be going, what? You know, but it's just we see so much stuff that I have a money back guarantee. In taking 300 tours out, only once did I have clients feel they didn't have a sighting. I took out two older couples and one or four people felt they hadn't seen anything. That was the only time that happened.
Hmm.
All the other 299 tours, we've always had sighting. There have been a handful of tours that were maybe less than five sighting. The significant number of tours have been five or more. And like this year, we've been averaging 15 and 20 sightings every night.
Wow.
And so a while back, someone said, well, how many toll signs do you have? And I thought, I haven't counted, but I kind of went back over some back records and decided I'd pick a really low conservative average, probably actually higher than this, but I said, okay, low conservative average, really conservative, would be like averaging 10 per tour. Granted, a few times less, many times, in fact, most times more. But anyways, 10 times 300 would be 3,000 sightings. And that's truly what we've had.
That's amazing.
I never dreamt in a million years when I started doing these tours, we'd have as many sightings as we do.
Do you get jaded after you've had so many? Because you're the one who goes,
you've had
all of them, essentially. So you're like, you ever just like, yeah, it's another one. I'm trying to check my Facebook here on my phone. Leave me alone.
Well, I'm laughing, but you're actually really true. I mean, I try not to. I try to have it be, fresh and exciting every tour. But my expectations are really high. Now, what we're seeing are lights at high altitude. And I educate everybody on planes, shooting stars, so those things are all very obvious. Very, very obvious.
Hmm.
Plane acquisition lights, they blink, they're very mechanical, they're actually very low, most of them are noisy, it's all really obvious. And as soon as people go out with me, they totally get it. They're like, oh, yeah, no, And then and shooting stars, and, of course, they burn out, they usually have a tail, they're very obvious.
Yeah.
And then we see things, now, of course, satellites. Satellites go across the sky on fixed trajectories. They're locked in with the rotation of the planet. They go in a perfectly straight line, very slow, from horizon to horizon. And they're not, we see things, predominantly what we see are things at very high altitude. But we see things that stop, turn, change direction, flying groups of, two, three, four in unison, zigzag, make an arcing turn, suddenly shoot off into space. Things that obviously don't do. And I've taken out satellite experts, and I've asked and astronomers and professional pilots, and every time I take out these extremely, qualified, people, I learn stuff from them. So I'm able to say unequivocally, we're usually able to rule out any of the known things, and then we're left with the unknowns because, again, like I said, we're seeing things satellites don't do. And and predominantly we're seeing lights high up, but we have...
Yeah, I was going to say, because I'm sure the skeptics, they always cling to these things that when you talk to somebody like what you're doing, you can easily have an answer for them, but then they, in a different setting, they'll just throw this out there where you don't have the chance to explain why they're wrong. So no bats, birds, and bugs. We're going to assume that you're not seeing that kind of thing.
Those things are all, those are extremely close and way out of focus when you're looking with the night vision goggles.
Right, that's what I mean. Like if someone ran into one of these skeptics on the street, that's what they would say, and we wouldn't have the chance to.
Yeah, no, you're not, once in a blue moon, we'll see a bird or a bug, but it's just a complete blur because it's actually really close to the goggles. It's totally different than these lights that we're seeing. That when I take out professional pilots, they're telling me what I'm seeing is generally at like 40 and 50,000 feet. It's up at like satellite height.
Yeah.
But again, when things make an arcing turn, if they zigzag, if they stop and change direction, if they're flying in groups of two or three or four together, again, satellites don't do that. And so it's really awesome. And I will say this. We have seen structured craft. And structured craft for the, novice out there just means like a classic UFO, when you see something close enough to really make out distinct structure, metallic structure or whatever, as opposed to just being a big glaring light that's just such a bright light, you're not seeing what the possible shape of it could actually be,
Yeah.
Structured craft we've seen 7 times, and some of those have been really phenomenal, large discs, probably 400 and 500 feet above us. I mean, extremely phenomenal things.
Yeah.
Yes, we've also, to varying degrees. I mean, that's like two of them. One time we had a big black triangle. It was up pretty high, but at arm's length, it was about a half inch in size. If you stick your hand way up and you hold your hand and you make it, space between your thumb and first finger saying, okay, you know, half inch, and then you take your hand down, you're still talking something pretty good, you know, maybe something at like helicopter height, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or small commuter plane kind of height, you know, that kind of thing. So, but we did see a nice black triangle one night. We've seen this twice, a big teardrop another time, a diamond shape another time.
It's all different sources. So,
the other two times were like big round spheres. But the two times we saw like disc, it was really spectacular right above us. So, you know, that's absolutely happened. But I always tell my clients, don't expect that. I mean, if it happens, great. It has happened seven times. But if you don't expect that and you're just expecting to see life at high altitude, you know.
Yeah.
We'll have some great sightings. And I've taken out, you know, many skeptics, you know, to varying degrees. And I've even taken out people who've, you know, had a previous sighting before and kind of need that fix. They're looking forward to seeing something again to help them make sense of what they previously saw, you know.
Now, do these things ever react like they know they're being watched by you guys? Because, you know, in some instances.
Yes. I don't always seem to do this, which is a shame, but I take out a laser pointer. Well, I always take out a laser pointer, but we use a laser pointer for pointing stuff out, and we pass the goggles around so everybody gets to see it, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I have multiple pairs of goggles that we share. I learned early on, or I knew this from other people previously doing this, that occasionally you could flash a laser at them and get them to flare up and reaction back.
Oh.
And so when I remember to do that, that's what I was commenting, that's a shame. I don't always remember, but we laser stuff and we flash at the laser and get it to, you know, flare up and reaction back. One kind of reaction or one flare up I'm not that impressed by, because I kind of want to have it happen again, although some of those are very bright and, you know, it's still very interesting. But there are some times when we get it to react 5, 6, up to, you know, 10 times reacting to a laser. And when it's constantly, and it seems like it's only flashing back when I'm flashing it with the laser, which doesn't just mean pointing at it. I'm going on and off with the laser really fast, and then leaving it off for a few seconds, and then going back to going on and off, on and off, on and off. And so if it is only flaring up right when I'm signaling it, then that seems to be, you know, pretty good indication that we're getting a reaction.
Right.
And particularly
right.
if it's happening a handful of times, you know. So, yes, we do have that. I'm getting better about remembering on tours now to do that more and to show my clients, and my clients are now doing it more. So we've been getting more reactions, but that's because we're doing it more.
Yeah, exactly. That's
and not everything does. I mean, a lot of times you're flashing away and something doesn't react. And could that have turned out maybe to be a satellite? Well, that's why we watch it for a while and see. But even if we have something doing something unusual, making an arcing turn or two or three things flying in unison, sometimes I'm flashing away at them, no reaction. And I'm always like, fine, be that way.
They're probably texting. But, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. All right.
But, you know, but a lot of times we get that reaction. And then, of course, I'm still going back to kind of your initial, you know, leading conversation here. I am still doing all my research. I still have cases. You know, one thing out here in Sedona is we have a large underground installation.
Yeah.
And depending on certain areas around Sedona, people will go out hiking. I could say times, day and night, mostly day, because you can't really go out in our wilds here and hike at night. It's just too dark, quite frankly. Yeah. But because we're a dark sky city, we actually have federal designation for being a dark sky city.
Oh, nice.
And which means we have very minimal lighting, and we're also at altitude, so our skies at night are extremely clear. I take people up on a hill that's at 4,700 feet. Anywhere in Sedona, you're at least 4,500 feet, and in certain areas, you can go up to about 5,000. Within the heart of Sedona, higher in the surrounding areas. But so I take people up on this hill. It's really clear. It's dark sky city, and that helps us. And then we use the night vision, like I said, which allows for over 20,000 times more light than you see with your naked eye. But Sedona is a hot spot. It always has been for sightings. And it's been long known by not everyone in town, but by many people in town, that we have this underground installation out here. And you can be out hiking down some of our canyons and trails. And these are well-marked, well-known hiking trails and canyons. So, you know, sometimes hundreds of people a day can go down.
Yeah.
And yet some, it depends on just if you're there, you know, long time, you can get stopped while out hiking by these guys in dark jumpsuits, with machine guns over their shoulder, saying you've entered a restricted area and you have to turn around.
Jesus.
Sometimes these guys approach in black Bronco trucks, or black SUVs, or even small black Jeeps, but I've heard reports of Jeeps, SUVs, and Broncos. And then the guys are always dressed all in black. I have had two accounts where the people were stopped actually at gunpoint, where the guns were drawn, as opposed to just over their shoulder. But I've had many cats share this, shared with me, a local well-known researcher in the area, who's well-known in ufology, who's written many books on the area out here, Tom Dongo. Tom Dongo's had multiple accounts of this, and a few other researchers in the area. So I've probably had, you know, 20 to 30 of these accounts shared with me. Tom's had about that many shared with him. Someone else I know says they've had about 10 accounts shared with them. And we could have some cross-correlation and hearing from the same people in some cases maybe, but, you know, obviously it's happening to quite a few people. And often people, when they tell me, only because they meet me and we have a conversation about something else, or they come out on a tour with me or something, then do they bring up that this happened to them or this happened to someone they knew. Right. But I'm just saying, this area has this happen where people are stopped and accosted by what appears to be military and told to, you know, turn around. And that's some just, you know, really strong supporting evidence for the fact that we have this installation out here.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have a lot of black helicopter accounts out here. It's well known that black helicopters land and refuel at our airport and fly into our canyons, and that's seen by many people. And people are always asking me, what's with the black helicopters? And I go, they're going out to the base.
Yeah.
Because they're seen out here a lot. And then also out here, I've had continued MILAB cases. MILAB just mean, for those who may not know, military abduction. Just
I want to get into
it. And this. It's actually an acronym I don't really like.
Oh.
It's known in ufology now, and so
yeah,
I
stuck
use it
with
because,
it, yeah.
You know, it's just kind of, I just kind of caved in, I guess, instead of what everybody calls it.
Well,
let's catch people up on that.
Let's start with, just give them a thumbnail since you, it's a good segue in a way, because tell them what a MILAB is and why you prefer it, a different nomenclature for that.
Okay, sure.
And we'll get into this.
MILAB just means, it's an acronym from MIL, meaning military, and AB for abduction. It tends to refer to, mostly, people who've had alien abduction experiences who then get targeted by human agencies. And often it also, particularly that term, refers to some of these people who are then targeted by human agencies will get abducted or picked up to be by human agencies to be interrogated or have follow-up medical procedures or be questioned or, you know, whatever, or threatened.
Yeah.
They did that too. And it's kind of become a catch-all phrase to mean any time that there's someone in ufology, mostly in the abduction field, whether they're an experienced or a researcher, but it can mean other people in ufology as well, who have this targeting by human agencies and involvement in their lives by human agencies. Of course, the long-known phenomena in ufology of men in black, or MIBs, falls into this category. But that was mostly an old term for what seemed to be an agents in suits or black coats,
yeah.
Long black coats sometimes, but where the agent was wearing all black, initially to a lot of the early accounts where they had like a black hat on, black sunglasses, but they also had kind of pasty white skin. A lot of times the people had encounters with these individuals thought that they were ETs or at the very least hybrids, was often reported. But over the years, there were also all sorts of threats and warnings and involvement from out and outright agents. Sometimes guys in suits coming to your door, sometimes plainclothes people getting involved in your life. So it branches into any time, basically, that there's
government harassment,
a human agency involvement with an abductee or a UFO researcher. But then with the abductees, so let's kind of just focus on that, because
yeah.
Like I said, it can happen to researchers too. But for the sake of my research is more or less people who've had the alien abduction experience who then become targeted by these human agencies. And it can be military. Often people say they not only operate or speak in a very militaristic sense, but then often are also seen in uniforms. Some people have experiences with what they could relate to as more of a lab environment with scientist types. And some have involvement with what seems to be like intelligence insiders, people from the intelligence community involved. And it gets into a lot of areas of research that are now known in mind control research, like targeted individuals and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it over the years, it's grown and become more complicated. Now, I choose to kind of, you know, everyone in ufology kind of, it's such a broad subject, as you well know.
Yeah.
And it covers so many areas that you kind of become a specialist. You know,
right.
You have your niche. And some people are very good at being the generalist, but they're still specialists, like I think of Richard Dolan, who looks at it from a historical context.
Exactly, yeah.
So he's still looking, his niche is historian, you know, looking at it from a historical context, but yet having a broad view, or at least over the years, he's had to broaden his view, for
right.
sure, you know. Paul Davis, who I know, I think you had on your thing recently, I looked on your website. So.
Nice.
Paul Davis does it from the viewpoint of a filmmaker.
Exactly.
So as a director, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you know. So everyone's got their niche. And certainly you have the abduction researchers and the Roswell researchers, and you have to go on and on and on.
Uh-huh.
So my niche really is saying, okay, my kind of prerequisite for taking on a case or really looking into something is saying, first off, that you're an alien abductee, that you've probably known that for a while. You're probably a fairly substantial case, and meaning evidence and witnesses and, you know, not always, but in general. And then you also have this human agency involvement show up. And the thing is, it can start very low grade and increase. And my research is, I mean, especially like in the last 8 years, it's really gone a lot further. It can start with, for instance, harassment, surveillance kind of stuff.
Yeah, this is
I mentioned black helicopters flying over, you know, Sedona earlier because they refuel up at the airport. But for instance, black helicopter harassment kind of stuff.
Right. Now, let me just jump in here because you sent me the graphic.
Yeah.
So we're going to kind of let's roll into that a little bit here.
Great. Oh, good. I'm glad you have that. That's
yeah.
that's perfect. In fact, I should try to see if I can bring that up on my computer really quick.
And for the folks listening, it's on the Binal page. It's on the we just posted it in the chat room for the live listeners. It's I don't really need to describe it too much because hopefully they can go check it out. But it's sort of like it's a curve here that has a whole bunch of different scenarios, I guess you could say, that happen to these
yeah.
folks. You know, as a result of this.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I so much in more recent lectures and presentations. Here, I'm going to look up the site myself. And And in recent lectures and whatnot, I was realizing I was trying to explain this. And so somewhere along the way, I said, I need a visual representation that both helps me be on track for, you know, explaining it to people.
Exactly.
But also just to give people an idea. And I came up with that and now I've tweaked it a little bit, but I think it's really kind of a nice visual representation of exactly where my research has gone and helps people understand how this subject matter works. That is a nice representation that I worked on real hard and tweaked, you know, periodically to have it really demonstrate that it starts off, like I said, and actually my research is now realizing that it also starts prior to the person actually having the alien abduction scenario. Here, for instance, we know, well known in abduction research, is alien abductions run in families. It tends to go back in the genealogical history of the abductee. It's extremely common in abduction research and abduction accounts for abductees to realize this goes back, you know, 2 and 3 generations for them. If you're an abductee, you realize it's happened to your parents. If you're an abductee, you have children, it also happens to your children. That's very common. There are many cases now that are aware that it goes back, you know, where, again, you're an abductee, it happens to your kids. Maybe if you and your kids are getting older and then they have kids, it happens to them. Or you learned it happened to your parents, then you learned it happened to your grandparents. So it's actually really common to have it go back 4 generations.
Wow.
And I even know of 2 cases where it goes back 5 generations.
Yikes.
There's this wonderful little piece of film footage that a filmmaker interviewed 4 generations in a family, a grandmother, mom, daughter, and grandchild, who were on sitting in, you know, with each other talking about their experiences where all 4 people are on camera. And I said, that's actually really, really good.
Yeah, that's powerful stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's well known in abduction research now. So when people look at this graph, I have this little, like, arching, you know, arrow, and then on there in red it says ET abduction. But there, prior to that, for instance, before someone has an ET abduction, often they have prior UFO sightings and psychic contact before they're an abductee. So a lot of times people are already having kind of a contact scenario even before the ET abduction, and then also realizing the genealogical involvement in their lives. And then some abductees question, could they have some kind of past life agreement to being involved? So that comes up as well. So it seems that even for an ET abductee, your being an ET abductee goes back prior to whatever your first alien abduction experience actually is.
Right,
where it can go back
your
in
hands.
Your family. It can go back with psychic contact and sightings. So there's this whole kind of life involvement before you realize, and a lot of abductees end up realizing, even though they may learn as an adult that this is happening, that they end up learning it's gone back in their life earlier than that. So it's kind of, pardon the expression, gray area. Sorry about that. It's kind of like, how do you define where this actually began? And what I'm learning is sometimes it begins with you have an ET abduction and that's the beginning. But in most cases, you're going to end up finding out it went back in your family. You're going to find out that maybe there was a past life connection agreement and that maybe you were having previous psychic stuff happen. So I'm just saying that's now more the norm. Carry involvement. With the covert ops involvement, that often goes back to families as well. When I'm meeting covert ops cases, I'm finding out that there's this whole pattern to stuff going back in their family. And I'm not surprised when I'm working with someone who's having the covert ops, and that's what I prefer to call, by the way, as opposed to saying in my lab, I prefer to call it a covert ops involvement or covert ops abduction. meaning black ops, covert operations. It did mean the human involvement and obviously covert in nature. And, you know, when you see covert ops in military terms or in intelligence terms, most people go, okay, got it. You know, it's kind of an instant recognition.
Right.
And covert operations and black ops. And, you know, most people now, I think, have a general understanding of what that might mean.
Certainly this audience, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, though, the covert ops involvement often goes back in the family as well. It can be everything from literally the harassment, surveillance, abduction scenario part of that. But it can also just be a family history and being involved in those kind of programs. Now, early on, I realized many abductees have military stuff going back in their families. But, you know, in a certain age bracket, you know, for to have a family member that is either in the military or was in the military or was in World War II, or Vietnam or Korea or something, you know, it's just, or Iraq, Iran, you know, it's all just, I realize that's not any kind of indicator. That's just common in general.
Yeah.
But realizing that, that people have family backgrounds, for instance, that go into military intelligence, Department of Defense work, aerospace work, intelligence work, CIA, NSA work, covert development programs, and also a little bit of some secret society stuff that comes up. And
oh,
it's
boy.
Usually not any one of those. It's usually multiples of those.
Yeah.
So when someone's having the covert ops involvement, I actually have a questionnaire with a bunch of questions, but some of them get into this category of, have you had a family member in this, that, or the other? And I am not surprised now at all. Initially, I kind of was, but now I'm not at all that people have family members that were in these various programs. Mm. And it's usually a combination. So it's like, oh, he was aerospace, he was intelligence, and he was a 30-degree member Mason, too. Oh, wow. You know,
exactly, yeah.
It just comes up so consistently that I expect it. I actually expect it. Now, it's not always there. It's not always there. So it's not an absolute, but I'm not surprised to find out that this goes back in the person's family. So then moving forward, if you're following on the graph, mm-hmm. so then at some point you have the ET abduction experience or you come to realizing that you're having that happen. And most people realize it happened to them previously as well. It tends to be an ongoing life involvement.
Right.
But then at some point, the abductee can start having threats and warnings, kind of like low-grade surveillance harassment. It can be everything from phone manipulation to some of the, you know, just the clicks and stuff on the phone. Okay, maybe. But it's gotten very aggressive in many cases where it's actually warning phone calls. It's actually another person clearly coming on the line in a conversation. You hear the person breathing. Sometimes the person will actually comment on the conversation. Sometimes these are electronic voices as opposed to what sounds like a live human. Sometimes they're clearly electronic in nature. So this has been happening with many, many people.
Yeah.
You can be watched and followed. You can be, you know, driving somewhere and be followed in your car, be out walking somewhere, realize you're being followed across the street, the person crosses the street with you, you're in an airport, you purposely go around a couple turns, the person's still there, that kind of thing. So it can be, you know, watched and followed.
This must be very traumatic for people because you're not only being abducted by aliens and then all of a sudden you're being harassed by other forces. I mean, this sounds like, because even if you're abducted, if you want to kind of put it behind you and you're like, all right, you know, I want to get on with my life. I don't want to experience this anymore or whatever. Next thing you know, you're thrown into the frying pan here.
Most abductees realize they will continue to experience it. That's another thing that's well known in alien abduction. It's extremely rare to have a one-time event. And even the well-known cases that you think are one-time events aren't. I want to emphasize for you that listening. Oh, so-and-so only had it once. Bullshit. Okay, I'm telling you that right now. We can start writing. Here's a good case, an example. Betting Barney Hill. They had continued experiences. They had my lab stuff extremely. I talked to Kathleen Martin, their niece, about they had harassment, surveillance, ongoing activity. Barney got picked up, got beat up, got interrogated. They are my lab cases. That's known in Spain.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm telling people, and had subsequent alien stuff. You know, a lot of the abductees go, I think I'm going to lay low about this, obviously. And yes, there could be some debate over the Walton case and that kind of thing, but I have reason to believe there was more. And I think there was certainly more with Mike, the crew boss at the time. And, you know, anyway, so I think there's just more there. And I think if he ever was willing to get regressed and everything, I think he'd find there was more.
Right.
And I don't think I'm being controversial. I think I'm just stating that this is the way it works. So for most people, though, you know, they're well aware that this is a repeated thing. And once you find out it's happening, it probably is going to happen again. It usually happens multiple times. And sometimes it can be extremely frequent, you know, where an abductee realizes they're having 100 experiences, you know, so it can really ramp up. But getting back to my graph here, so the way this ramps up in someone's life is, so then they have the harassment surveillance. Then they might have, like I said, the threats and warnings. So initially, it just seems to be kind of surveillance. It's non-invasive, really. It's just more annoying. But then there can actually be threats and warnings, like receiving threatening or warning phone calls, having people come to your door and warn you away from the subject or approach you in a public place, this kind of thing. So it can ramp up to that. Then it can, and that's the next thing is kind of an offshoot of that, which is the MIB experience, the Men in Black experience or government agent, and a very overt kind of threatening situation. Then a lot of abductees realize they have abduction experiences where they're seeing aliens and military together. And this is actually real common. I mean, you know, a lot of abductees, even though they may not have a lot of this other deepening involvement, they do have some experiences where they've seen aliens and military in the same place. Most abductees feel that they're often in an underground base situation. But like sometimes you're on board a ship and there just happens to be a military personnel there. Now, it's one thing if you see someone who's military who you think might be another abductee, because there are, of course, many mass and group abductions. But if the person is seeming to operate in some kind of official capacity or instructive capacity or monitoring what's going on, that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're like free to walk around and they
have,
they're not.
And if you're an abductee and you have an experience where you think you've, you know, gone to an underground base situation, it could be predominantly military with only a little bit of ET activity. So it starts to be where there's alien abductions that have a little bit of military presence in it, and then there's military abductions that it's kind of very, you know, disquieting to the abductee if they have a human experience. They feel they were abducted by these covert ops types or military, actually have removed them from their car, from their home, whatever, and go to a very human installation, you know, clearly military base, clearly research or science facility. They're having, for all intents and purposes, a completely human experience, but then have present where they see ETs in the room or an ET is brought in to interface with them in some way. I mean, when people initially have this, it's very strange and very disconcerting, you know, initially to the abductee. Just so people know I haven't really brought this up. What got me involved in researching, I'll backtrack for a second. Can I do that? Is it okay?
That's fine.
Because I realized people are going, wow, how'd you get all into this? Because we jumped ahead into the research, and I'll continue on with how this ramps up. But
no problem.
Backtracking just for a second, I've had experiences with this. You know that. I knew that. Your listeners don't all know that.
Yeah.
I now realize I've had about 9 or 10 experiences with this. I just realized the other day I may have remembered something that I don't know if is on my initial list. that, but whatever. Roughly 9 or 10 experiences of this myself. It was my own experiences in first I was self-investigating that I was having alien abductions.
Right.
Working with some therapists, some hypnotherapists, some researchers in the field, meeting other abductees. And then somewhere along the way, I realized I'd had this harassment surveillance stuff and talked to other abductees and learned, oh, yes, other people are having this happen. Talked to some researchers, learned they knew of other cases with this. And then that continued to happen to me. So it was out of self-investigating what was happening to me that I met other people. And I was already encouraged by a number of researchers to go public with my alien abduction experience. Well, in going public, it made sense when I realized that this was going on to breach kind of this subject, to bring it up and talk about what was and what I heard was happening to other people. Well, then I was encouraged by so many researchers to do more of that. One tremendous influence on me back then was the late Dr. Carla Turner.
Yes.
And Carla Turner said, "Melinda, you got to talk about this here. You know, you got to experience this." And she really encouraged me to proceed with it. And I did while she was still alive. And, of course, you know, of course, even more so after her passing.
Mm-hmm.
But I, because I've been very involved in ufology and in the research circles and speaking at conferences and lecturing and radio, TV, whatever, and then I used to produce a monthly lecture series many years ago. For about 9 years, I had speakers every month. So I was known as an event producer as well. And so I got to really get around in ufology, as the case may be, got to know people, and became really good friends with a lot of key researchers and abduction researchers as well. And those abduction researchers have always been extremely supportive of my doing this. In fact, I've never not had support from the major abduction researchers. And even now, I have a group of people that have formed a new organization, apparently that's just formed. It's a research organization. I spoke about Kathleen Martin, she's involved, Barbara Lamb, a few other key people, and they're approaching me saying, "We need to incorporate your covert ops my lab work into this, and we're wanting to know your questionnaire, like how do you know if this has happened to people? What do you ask them? You know, that kind of thing."
Right. Exactly.
And of course, I'm going to share all my data with them. By the way, folks, if any of them are listening, and people, and this is, I think this. I might think, you know, Sprinkles involved. It's got like huge, 10 huge people on their board. But I, of course, I'm going to absolutely share myself with them. I need to respond to them because this is something literally just happened this week that they're contacting me.
All right.
But I'm so glad to hear that not only are they starting this new research organization, but that they're wanting to include all this. And they see the need to, and they're wanting to come up with a comprehensive questionnaire to ask people about this. And you know, and I'm more than happy to share my stuff with them. But just so you, I just want your audience to know that I started with my own experiences and realizing what was happening and then meeting other people. And now, of course, obviously, I'm known in ufology for this work.
That's right. Yeah, you're a mover and a shaker in the MyLab world.
Well, I'm kind of by default. I'm like the last man standing.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.